Partly cloudy skies here in South Florida.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper here along with Bonnie Berman. Good afternoon, Bonnie.
Good afternoon.
Good to see you again.
Likewise.
Today we highlight the ambitious LIGHT, the Holocaust and Humanity Project in Miami-Dade County. Joining us is the interim director of the Florida Anti-Defamation League, Yael Hirschfield. Welcome to you. Thanks for coming on our program.
Thank you.
Also with us is John Richard. He's the president and CEO of the Adrian Arsht Center for the Performing Arts. It's the locale of several big events in the project. Good to see you again, John Richard.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Joe and Bonnie.
We also have Miriam Klein-Kasanoff. She's a survivor, Holocaust survivor, who heads the Holocaust Education Program at Miami-Dade Public Schools. It's good to see you again, Miriam.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, John, could you give us some background on LIGHT, the Holocaust and Humanity Project?
I would love to. We're kicking off and launching a three-month convening of our community that has been inspired by a new work from a company called Austin Ballet. And we've created a convening of our community on the topic of the many topics of the human race and our treatment of each other, with the inspiration being the learning that we can draw from in our community, a very diverse community, of the horrific outcome in the experiences of the Holocaust. And we found that from the Ballet Austin Company, a new work that represents the life of one survivor, a magnificent story through ballet and music. And what we're learning now with the different groups participating in this project is there's a lot of stories to listen to. And there is much to share as it relates to our community learning from these horrific events that occurred well over 70 years ago.
Miriam Klein-Kasanoff, tell us a bit of your Holocaust story and your involvement in the Holocaust and Humanity Project. There are very few survivors left. It's a remarkable story you have.
Thank you. First, I just want to clarify the term survivor is related to me, because I'm sure there are listeners out there who survived the camps, the ghettos, Auschwitz, who we honor what they went through. But there's another level of survivor called child survivor, hidden child. And that generation is just beginning to come forth. We are the youngest who would have been under the age of 8 or 10, who managed somehow to escape the horrors of the Holocaust in the early years, by either hiding in the forest, being given away to Gentile families, or in my case, I was actually with my parents, and our category is called hiding and on the run, in that in 1940, my father escaped a Hungarian labor concentration camp, came home, grabbed my mother, myself, and my infant brother, the late federal judge Ted Klein, who was only 9 months old, and we began a route of escape throughout Eastern Europe for 7 months, hiding and running with the Nazis on our heels, finally arriving in Lisbon, Portugal in 1941, and ultimately arriving in America in June of 1941. So that category is considered a child survivor of the Holocaust.
And Yael, and of course, Miriam, we'll get back to you and your involvement in this project. Has there been a rise in anti-Semitic activities and hate crimes in Florida in recent years?
It's interesting that you mentioned that we see a rise generally across the world. But just to mention two cases of hate crimes that happened this week alone in Florida. A gay man in Jacksonville was accosted, and a black man in Ormond Beach just received a hateful message at the doorsteps of his home, basically saying, "You're not welcomed here." Mm. So these things are happening, and the opportunity to have a conversation about differences, about who we are and how we react to hate in our communities, because the issue is not whether hate happens, because it will happen, but how as a community we respond to it is what makes the difference. And the ability to have that conversation with this ballet hosted by the Arts Center is a phenomenal opportunity, and it's not coincidental that ADL has decided to partner with the Arts Center given the 100 years that we're celebrating. This is what we do. This is what we are here for, to combat hate. And this conversation in the community is happening, and we're just grateful to be a part of it.
There's many other events involved also. Tell us about some of those.
Well, the Anti-Defamation League in Miami-Dade has been very active in the school districts, and we have our No Place for Hate initiative, where we provide bullying and cyberbullying trainings for teachers and for students. And really, that's the lesson, one of the lessons of the Holocaust, is if we don't stop hate from its inception, from the prejudice, from the stereotypes, from escalating, then we can end up in a very bad space. And that's one of the things that we're doing. I know that other community organizations have jumped on board, very excited to participate in this conversation. There are theaters that are being put on in different organizations that are hosting different types of events. There's the Miami Coalition for Christians and Jews, which is now all-encompassing and is holding on Sunday a dialogue, A Nation Under One God, and invited all kinds of religions to participate. So this is a phenomenal opportunity, and everyone is excited and participating.
How about a website where people could learn about these varied events?
Well, I'll let John talk more about it, but every community that has agreed to participate is posting their own events on the Arts Center's website, but you can go to any one of the organizations and learn about it.
Miami-Dade schools are part of it.
That's a mouthful.
And there's also the Arts Center's website, which is artscenter.org. But this coming weekend, there is an amazing convening of community in the Knight Concert Hall as we receive and hear from Dr. Michael Barenbaum, who will be with us for a free community event. And his discussion, lecture, and conversation with the community is titled, "What We Know About the Holocaust, What We Have Learned, and What We Still Want to Know." This for the Arts Center conveys our sense of purpose of being not just a world-class performing arts institution, but community-based in our outreach and engagement. And they're not mutually exclusive categories.
Miriam, do you feel that comparing the death camps with schoolyard bullying or hatred, do you feel that it minimizes this chapter, this horrific chapter in our history? Or do you feel it's an appropriate comparison, and why?
It's a really excellent question, because there's a lot of questions going around about that, particularly to those of us who are Holocaust educators. So I have dug deep into my brain and heart as to how I feel about that. And yeah, I would agree with Yael. I feel that the Holocaust, the Nazi Holocaust of 1933-1945, is definitely the lowest point of what could happen when we allow hatred intolerance to be perpetrated.
Right.
So how does that begin?
Okay.
And it does begin with very early stages of exclusion, concentration, people being intolerant, and that equates to bullying. So that, for example, if you look at the history of early 1930s, 1933, 1934, 1935, right after the Nuremberg Laws, I often tell the anecdote of a Jewish boy, and this is a true story, and his best friend, who was a German Gentile, actually stood by and watched the Nazi youth gangs bully him, beat him, and take his bicycle. It haunted the Jewish boy, Chaim, the rest of his life. He survived Auschwitz. He went back to Germany. He confronted the Gentile boy, Victor, and said, "Why did you just stand there and not do anything?" And Victor said, "I don't even remember what you're talking about." Mm-hmm. So one was haunted by the bullying all his life, and the other just stood by and said, "I don't even remember that." So yes, I do think that lessons in bullying are connected. They're not the Holocaust, but they're connected.
John, do you think the arts can have a positive impact on the way people think, they act, the way they behave? Do you think that this can be effective? It's a very far-reaching program and project.
I'm really proud of the Arts Center encouraging us to take this step and to use our stages as a platform for this community discussion and appreciation of each other. If we hadn't taken this on as a very special effort and initiative, with an outreach ingredient to it, I didn't know Miriam 2 months ago. I didn't know Yael 2 months ago. And we have so much in common and also have so many different experiences to bring. And just listening to Miriam now, I heard a story I wasn't familiar with. And it causes you to pause and think more deeply about yourself, your community. And I really believe that the Arts Center is poised to convene our community on our stages for ballet, discussion, lecture. And that's why I think of the Arts Center as Miami's new town square, that our diversity, our community is a place for us to gather.
We're speaking with, this is the Light and the Holocaust and Humanity Project. We're speaking with the interim director of the Florida Anti-Defamation League, Yael Hirschfield. John Richard is the president and CEO of the Adrian Arsch Center for the Performing Arts. And Miriam Klein Kasanoff is a child survivor who heads the Holocaust education at Miami-Dade Public Schools. So what is being done to target the youth and whoever wants to take that question?
I would love to do that. As I said, you know, there are things happening in schools, and we as an organization that has developed an immense amount of educational resources, because we understand that people are not born hating. They're not born with prejudice and stereotypes. Those are learned lessons that we internalized. And so we have partnered with the school district to bring bullying programs or anti-bullying programs to schools. And like Miriam said, you know, the Holocaust happened because a determined group of people wanted to make harm, but because a substantial amount of the society were bystanders. And that's the kind of lesson that we learn from the Holocaust and the kind of lesson that we bring to the schools. There's going to be the bully and there's going to be the bullied. But what about the bystanders? What are all those students, teachers, administrators doing when these things occur in the schools? And that's the kind of training that we bring to the schools, giving real tools and resources for students to be able to feel comfortable enough to stand up and say, "Not in front of me. You will not talk like that about an immigrant. You will not talk about like that about a gay person. Not in front of me." And that's a phenomenal lesson for any student or teacher or administrator to take home with.
Right. And social media is a new avenue for bullying and hatred, with the potential of thousands and thousands of people seeing hatred and bullying.
Absolutely. And the harm is exponential, because whereas before a bullying or a comment was on a one-on-one basis, now it's posted on Facebook or on any other social media, and, right. and it's exponential. 100 people can see it at once, and their friends and so forth. So it's a real problem, and we have real solutions that we're implementing in the school systems.
Miriam, you wanted to add something?
Thank you, Yael, for your good work. First of all, this is completely unsolicited by John. I want to tell you that I have worked with many, many, many organizations around the country and the world. I just can't tell you what a gem we have with Arsch. This staff is so incredibly dedicated, hardworking, constantly in touch with me every day about the program, because we're doing this weekend symposium, which is educational. And I encourage anyone out there, if you want to really spend a day in high academic learning, as I did in Jerusalem, where I modeled this program that we're having this weekend, come Sunday. There are tickets still available to the symposium. Not only are we having Dr. Michael Berenbaum speaking Saturday night as the opening speaker, who's a colleague and a friend of mine on the Holocaust and the history of it, and showing a world preview premiere of a piece of Treblinka, a film that WLRN is making.
Right.
But we have a presentation that I think everyone will be interested in. We have Dr. Medoff, Raphael Medoff from New York, who I saw in Jerusalem this summer, and I was so taken with this, I asked him to come. He's going to show how America had knowledge of what was going on in Europe during the Holocaust through the political cartoons that were in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to show those, the original cartoons. And we also have Dr. Cheyenne Martin, who's part Indian and is a professor nurse from the University of Texas, who's going to talk about a very little known subject, and that's how doctors and nurses resisted through healing in the camps when people like Mengele were not looking. So I urge the community to come to these programs all day Sunday.
That's Sunday. Uh-huh. Okay, and yeah. What time does that begin?
That begins at 10. We'll finish at 5 with a little film that I'm showing on bystanders called The Pigeon. It's an 11-minute film. And there'll be coffee all day, and people can come in and out. It's the first of this kind of symposium that ARSHT is hosting in this community.
Okay. Miriam, I'm sorry.
Speaking of bystanders, briefly relate the story of the St. Louis vessel, which was such a tragedy for so many people.
Well, in 1938, German Jews were given the opportunity to buy visas if they had the money. It was quite expensive to board the St. Louis ship and come to America to escape. And I should know this by heart. I wrote a book with this in it, but I'm sure someone out there is going to call in and say I had the wrong number. But there were about 800 passengers. And there was a Gentile captain. And when the ship had to stop in Havana first, because the original papers were from Havana, the visa papers. But when it got to Havana, politics wouldn't allow the Jews off the ship. So the captain didn't know what to do. And he thought, well, there's a lot of Jewish people in Miami Beach, Florida. Let me take the ship on up to Miami Beach, Florida and see if I can help these people. When it got to Miami Beach, right outside by the Fountain Blue, as a matter of fact, the immigration laws would not allow those Jews to get off. The ship was sent back, and the Jews were scattered throughout countries. Now, historically, it's a myth now, because it's not true that all of them were eventually murdered in the Holocaust. We have since historically found out that more than half have been found and survived.
Oh, okay.
So that's a bystander, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Do you find the teachers and the students receptive to learning about the Holocaust in schools, or do you perceive resistance to that?
I have absolutely no resistance, which is incredible. On October 26th, we are having a Holocaust teacher in service. The first one this year is part of the ARSHT program outreach. As of now, I just looked on my website, I have 173 teachers registered from 173 different schools. The teachers are very engaged in this subject.
Hmm.
Yael, is there a resurgence in Holocaust denial in recent years?
Well, we see it in unfortunately, when world leaders are putting on conferences like Iran about Holocaust denial and the ability of people like that to really be listened throughout the world, it engages others in the same conversation. And while we are grateful for our freedom of speech here in the United States, it's a value that we hold very dear, it also allows for people to engage in conversations as Holocaust denial, which doesn't happen in other parts of the world. There are clear laws against Holocaust denial in some countries in Europe. We don't have that. So it is more than imperative, it's essential that we continue to teach the Holocaust in our school districts to be able to combat that thought, that argument, that narrative to even creep into our conversations here in the United States.
So do you believe that good can triumph over evil? Miriam, I'll ask all three of you, actually.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Absolutely. The Anti-Defamation League is going to be celebrating 100 years in which we have chosen to do our kickoff centennial event with the Arts Center in partnership with the Ballet. And if we didn't think that we could triumph against evil, we wouldn't be in the business of doing the kind of work that we do. So absolutely, yes.
John?
Totally on board. 3 for 3.
I don't think
in the
so.
World Series of good and evil, there's only one team to pick on this one, and it's the good team. And you know, we talked earlier your question about the thread of the Holocaust into human rights issues that are not on the same level of the horrific events of the Holocaust. And there was one simple communication that came through to me that made it very clear of what the common thread was, and it was the term indifference.
Right.
The what happened was 5% of the population destroyed 1% of the population, and 94% of the population did nothing. That statistic, as far as statistics go today, and for all the fact checkers that are out there in America today that check facts, is a very powerful reminder of what everyone's individual responsibility is about and caring for others in society. And we can no longer just stand by and watch and pretend it doesn't happen to us.
Right.
Give us a thumbnail, John, reviewing some of the other the remaining events in the Light the Holocaust and Humanity Project.
Well, there are many, many community organizations, and Miriam just listed this coming weekend. The focal point is November 3rd and 4th when we present Ballet Austin Light. This is a magnificent ballet, and we were won over to this concept, this choreographer by the name of Stephen Mills's concept. Who was not Jewish and was motivated to do this program by a survivor. And I think the metaphor of dance for so much of the photography, that the black and white photography that we are familiar with, came out of the Holocaust, the physicality of the Holocaust and what occurred to human beings, and why dance is such an important art form to communicate the physicality of movement, the physicality of human beings moving through space through the sound of music, portraying the life of one survivor. And I think that this is something that will have a ribbon around it in perpetuity, that other companies, dance companies from around the world, and this dance company is going to Israel next year in September for 5 performances of this piece, will commemorate and help us keep alive the story of the Holocaust long after the last survivor is no longer on the planet Earth.
Unbelievable. Tell me more about what's available to Miami-Dade students as far as Holocaust education, Miriam.
Well, we have Holocaust education year-round. I'm very proud to say this. I am one of the few Holocaust educators in a public school system. I do give thanks to people. Our superintendent, Mr. Carvalho, has made sure for years that Holocaust education stays a priority along with some of the school board, most of the school board members, Dr. Feldman, Dr. Karp. So we have a full year-round Holocaust education program. Work very closely with Yael and ADL. We do programs, Echoes and Reflections, which is a Holocaust curriculum ADL has produced. We have, I think, almost 8 Holocaust elective courses in our public schools, more than any other school in the state of Florida. Our students have Holocaust education programming, curriculum, instruction all year long.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us today. This has been, you can check into LIGHT, the Holocaust and Humanity Project, at thearshcenter.org. We've been joined by the interim director of the Florida Anti-Defamation League, Yael Hirschfield. John Richard is the president and CEO of the Adrian Arsch Center. And Marion Klein Kasanoff is a child survivor who heads the Holocaust education at Miami-Dade Public Schools. We thank you so much for joining us.
Food and Dining is next.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day, half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Festival Miami, Broward Stage Door Theater, Miami Acting Company, and Actors Playhouse. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. Culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts.
The Heineken Downtown Miami Concert Series kicks off this Friday at the Tina Hills Pavilion at Bayfront Park, featuring a free concert by Sister Hazel at 7:15. The festival begins at 5 p.m. with a farmer's market with locally made and organic products, an arts and crafts vendor showcase, and the Heineken Beer Garden. You can experience beautiful downtown Miami with fun for the whole family. Details at dwntwnconcerts.com. It's hard to say what it is I
see. WLRN is funded by listeners like you and by Best Roofing, South Florida's forensic roofing specialists, diagnosing and correcting South Florida's commercial roofing problems since 1975. Information at bestroofing.net. The Miramar Cultural Center presents an encounter with Simone Weil on Thursday, October 11th at 7:30 p.m., a film of her dramatic story about living life with compassion. Tickets at 954-602-4500 or miramarculturalcenter.org. Nobody likes sitting in traffic, but you can help Miami-Dade County do something about it. Blocking an intersection causes major gridlock. It's not only frustrating, it's illegal, and you could get fined. So do your part to keep traffic moving, keep intersections clear, don't block the box. Details at miamidade.gov/MOVN.
Legendary 15-person ensemble Orquesta Aragon comes to South Florida, igniting the stage in a fury of Latin rhythms at Arts Garage in Delray Beach. Thursday, October 18th available, Friday the 19th is sold out. More information and tickets at artsgarage.org.
Hello, Bonnie Berman here. Join us for Monday's Topical Currents when we discuss how best to parent kids with practicing psychologist Dr. Madeline Levine. She's written the book, Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. Her message is that values and coping skills matter more than grades, trophies, or a college fat envelope. Tune in Monday at 1 o'clock for Topical Currents.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman with you today. Our Food and Dining Thursday is finally here. Joining us now is chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. Linda, it's mid-October. The baseball season is culminating. There's football each weekend. And today's topic is beer, but I don't think we're going to talk about Pabst Blue Ribbon or Budweiser.
Joe, beer is flowing in the streets these days. Absolutely. October brings lots of beer festivals, and if you've missed one of them, there's going to be a big one this Saturday, Grovetoberfest. It's in Coconut Grove. And we've been celebrating right here, and that's in the studio with the help of Chef Lou Ramirez. He's from Lou's Beer Garden in North Beach, and he's brought us some beer-friendly food that we've been eating.
Welcome. I saw you sampling earlier during our first interview.
Okay, I saw you looking. Welcome, Lou Ramirez. Yeah,
thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. And also with us is certified Cicerone. That's Cicerone, Chris Montelius. He's here to introduce us to craft beer. Welcome, Chris Montelius.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And we'd love to have you, our listeners, join in. Do you have any questions for our expert? What's your favorite draft beer? Or maybe craft beer. And why? Give us a call. Questions or suggestions, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
And with us is our favorite wine. Can I call him wine? I have to call him a beer guy.
Yeah, he's...
Favorite beer guy today. It's Fred Tasker. You can read Fred's column in today's Miami Herald, and he's joining us by Skype. Fred, do I ask what we're drinking today?
Well, we might be drinking a little beer. In fact, I'm sitting here actually drinking a beer, probably unlike you folks. But I'm going to lay some numbers on you.
Sorry, Fred. We are drinking beer.
Oh, you are?
Yes,
well, good for you. I'm going to lay some numbers on you about the rise of craft beer and the fall, slight fall of light beer.
Well, all right. Interesting stuff. Chef Lou, let's first talk about, you have Lou's Beer Garden, and it's called a gastropub. So what's that?
A gastropub. When you think of a gastropub, think of the British answer to the French bistro. Seasonal and always ever-changing, for sure.
Okay, so it's good food and a pub.
Correct.
Not just pub food.
Not just pub food.
Bar food either, as he's brought in. It's pretty fancy stuff.
Unbelievable what he's
brought. Are you eating any bangers and mash?
No.
No.
We did better than that.
Yeah, much better, Fred. Much better. Chris Montelius, Cicerone. What is that?
Cicerone means guide. It's essentially just a beer sommelier, though. It's a guide through the world of beer, just as a sommelier would guide you through wine.
Okay. We've been talking about this food that Fred is not having. So you brought us beer-friendly food. Chef, tell us, what did you bring?
I brought a pan-seared Berkshire lollipop pork chop.
Wait, this is not just a lollipop pork chop. This is an enormous pork chop.
it was a nice portion. It was seared, and it was actually glazed with a Maibock.
Maibock is a type of beer?
Yeah, it is a type of beer.
What is it?
It's a beer that is mainly brewed during the month of May in Germany. It is very complex. This one specifically, it's brewed in Portland, Oregon by Rogue Brewing Company, an amazing product. It gave the pork chop quite, the depth and complexity that you look, just, like in a wine, when you use wine for
cooking. So you make the sauce out of the beer.
That is correct.
But, when I cook beer, it gets very bitter. So how do you compensate?
How do you balance? Well, you have to balance the bitterness with more additives, such as perhaps something sweet, perhaps what I use in my sauce. The one that you tried was a fig preserve, actually good quality fig preserve, which brought more depth and sweetness to the actual dish. It balanced it out. It balanced the bitterness that is found in the molten barley.
Great! Wow.
I have a question. What is a craft beer?
I guess I'll take that one.
Okay.
Craft beer is generally beer that is made with four ingredients, malted barley, water, hops, and yeast. There's no adjuncts or additives that some of the bigger brewers use, like corn and rice, to lighten the flavor. So it's everything that is put into the beer is there to accentuate and to bring more flavor to the beer. It's also made by one of the smaller breweries typically under 2 million barrels produced per year.
And what would a big producer produce?
A lot more.
A lot more. Okay.
So, well, now we have craft beer and we have draft beer. So what's the difference?
Well, draft beer is just beer that is served on tap from a faucet rather than packaged in a bottle.
And that can be any kind of beer.
Any beer can be draft beer.
Right.
But the better ones are craft beer.
Is it true that a draft beer would have fewer preservatives in it?
Typically, yes. The bigger breweries will pasteurize their beer. They'll add shelf stabilizers and things to extend the life of the beer. But your craft brewers tend to add less of that stuff, and they tend to travel less as well. Your craft beers are typically going to be more local, not shipped halfway across the world. And it's always going to be kept cold and stored properly to prevent any spoilage, rather than having chemicals added to
it. And presumably sold more quickly.
Hopefully, yes.
So, and we had a question that Chef Lou brought up just before. Is something about gluten beer.
Gluten-free.
Gluten-free, sorry.
Gluten-free is actually becoming very popular because more and more people are realizing that they have gluten allergies. I guess basically a few years ago, it was much harder to test for, and a lot of people weren't aware that they had a gluten deficiency or allergy. And gluten-free beer is just made with rice or sorghum or a grain besides barley or wheat that does not have gluten.
Like, so what other grain would it be made with?
The rice or sorghum.
Oh, just the rice or sorghum.
Right.
Right.
Okay, I thought
And are there several beers now being made gluten-free?
Absolutely. One that we distribute is out of Boulder, Colorado, New Planet. It's a craft gluten-free beer, and they're doing fantastic.
Okay, we have a phone call here.
Okay.
We'll go to Andy. Andy in Sunny Isles. Hi, Andy. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just had a question for the Cicerone.
Okay.
Sure.
I was wondering, we see and we hear a lot about the growth of craft beer, but I was wondering if you had any thoughts on why South Florida seems to be lagging the nation.
I think that there's a few reasons. Number one, Miami is the biggest city in the country that I can think of that does not have a proper local brewery. And that definitely helps spur that into action. When there's a local brewery, people tend to see it a lot more and drink a lot more. But we also have a lot of transplants from all over the place. And South Florida is also very international. So we're one of the largest import markets. That's all changing, though.
Go ahead, Bondi, you have a question?
Yeah, I have a question, which is a little...
Well, thanks, Andy.
Yeah, thank you. It's a little different than that, which was used to be only, this is Peter in Miami, used to be only Budweiser and Miller in supermarkets. Now you can find Dogfish Head brand 90-minute IPA, whatever that is, on the shelf. To what do you attribute the explosion in popularity of the more complex beers?
Well, I actually work for the distributor for the company that does Dogfish, and I've been working the Miami market for 5 years, and it just... it takes someone that's passionate about the product to go out there and see these retailers. I talk to restaurants and bar owners, people like Lou, every day and try and get them to bring better beer in. I think beer is going to be just as important as wine lists in restaurants very soon, if it's not already.
Hmm. I've found that too, that as people become more sophisticated about wine, they become more sophisticated about beer too, and they start looking for things that actually have flavor.
Absolutely.
Right. Also, there's going to be at Grovetoberfest this Saturday. Chef, you're going to be doing a cooking demonstration. Is that right?
That is correct. At the Kitchen Lab at Grovetoberfest, I'm going to be doing the same dish that you just tried.
You're going to do that pork with the creamed lentils and the salad.
Fantastic dish.
Creamed golden lentils.
Wow, that was so good. Well, my mouth is watering, but we're going to take a break. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guests are Chef Lou Ramirez and Cicerone Chris Montilius. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN and South Florida's NPR news station, 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys.
We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, Alliance for Aging, Hanley Center, and Jackie Abraham Jewelers. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs that you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support.
Next time on South Florida Arts Beat, our area's premier big band, the South Florida Jazz Orchestra, under the direction of Chuck Bergeron, performs compositions from their latest recording, Trumpet Summit. Featuring original Bergeron and Brian Lynch compositions and grand standards, the band's new arrangements are fresh and exciting. Hear jazz brilliance, the South Florida Jazz Orchestra, Friday on South Florida Arts Beat at 1 o'clock.
We're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Chef Lou Ramirez from Lou's Beer Garden in North Beach and certified Cicerone, Chris Montelius. We've been celebrating all kinds of different kinds of beer, learning about food and beer tasting. And by the way, Grovetoberfest this Saturday at Peacock Park in Coconut Grove. It's at 3 p.m., VIP entry, 4 p.m., as general entry, and it goes on until 7 p.m. and there's still tickets left. So if you are interested, go to grovetoberfest.com. Also, I was told that if you go to their Facebook, you get a discounted ticket. So that's Grovetoberfest.
What's the certification process? How much do you have to go through?
There's three levels.
To be a professional beer server.
Well, the certified beer server is actually the first level, and that's an online test you can take. It's about 60 multiple choice questions. That one is relatively easy. I think that most people that work in a bar, if they serve good beer, should be able to pass that. The second level, the certified Cicerone, is definitely more difficult. It's 150 fill-in-the-blank questions, 12 tasting questions on style, off flavors, and you know whether a beer is fit to serve, as well as essay questions on food and beer pairing, things like that.
Then I guess I won't try for that.
Talking about food and beer pairing, it's Dinner in Minutes time. And this is a beer-friendly Philly cheesesteak. Okay, so yeah, Joe's looking at me.
Now, there's some bar food.
There you go. It's one of Philadelphia's most famous dishes, and I recently came back from Philly and had a craving for one, but I didn't have a craving for all the mound of calories involved with it. So this one captures the flavor without the guilt. So I sauteed some onions and bell peppers, green and red, whatever you like, and take them slowly, about 10 minutes, really, so they get nice and caramelized. Remove that, and then I sauteed some sliced steak, just a couple of minutes. Don't overcook
Very
it.
Very thinly sliced,
Very
I
thin,
hope.
Yes. Yes, Joe.
Okay.
And then hoagie bread or a sub roll, slice it in half lengthwise. I put the onions and peppers on one layer on the bottom half. Then I put the steak. Now, here comes the cheesy part. The cheesy part has to be a cheese spread, and for those of you who are interested in lowering the calories, there is a light cheese whiz out. And don't put, no, Joe, listen, it tastes really good.
I thought you were going to say Velveeta.
Yeah, really.
You could. One could. It's melted in the microwave for about 10 seconds and poured over the steak. Now, some people have ketchup with it. Some people have a marinara. You're shaking your head.
No.
Chris is shaking
ketchup?
His head. Ketchup? Yes, they do. Or marinara sauce. But that's up to you. That recipe is in today's Miami Herald. You can see it there. Also, at Dinner in Minutes, I have a stout soused chicken that you can make using beer in my recipe. And you can see that at dinnerinminutes.com. Or follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Or I'm on Facebook. So, Fred, are we drinking beer today?
Absolutely. There's actually good news today for all beer drinkers. For the first time since 2008, overall beer sales are up nationwide by 1.8%. But there is a big change. Light beer, which was first introduced by Miller in 1975, and today it actually makes up four of the five best-selling brands in America, dropped another 1.5% for the third straight year. So people what's pumping up beer in America is, as we're learning today, craft beer. It is actually up 6% and makes up, I mean up 12% and makes up 6% of the total U.S. beer market. So it appears that American...
And Chris is shaking his head. Yes, yes.
I agree.
He agrees
with
you. Yeah,
it appears that Americans have finally grown tired of wimpy light beer and are demanding something radical and new in their beer, which is called flavor.
Fred, didn't you used to call it the lawnmower beer?
Yeah, those are craft beer makers call light beer lawnmower beer because the only time they would drink it is after they've gotten through in the 95 degree heat mowing the lawn. But craft beer is defined by the American Brewers Association as beer that's made by a brewer that is small, independent, and traditional, and brewed, as we said, in no more than 2 million barrels a year. And craft beers taste very different from American light beers. Light beers are mostly light-bodied old German-style pilsners from the German immigrants who came in the U.S. in the 1800s. And it's brewed even lighter in America using rice and things when they need to, so that you can drink them through an afternoon of football on TV without getting too full.
You can still see the game.
And still see the well. Actually, the alcohol is the same, so you have to. As in regular beer, but craft beers are brewed for flavor, and one of the major differences is the amount of hops in them. Hops are what give beer its refreshing bitterness, and that's actually measured in IBUs, which are International Bitterness Units. And you can really tell the difference. A typical light American beer might have an IBU rating of 5 or 10. And a craft beer is going to be at least 30 or 45.
Linda just had her first IPA earlier, and it was about 80 IBUs.
Yeah, those things are powerful. Actually, the Dogfish Head 90-minute IPA, which means India Pale Ale, has an IBU of 90.
Right.
So anyway, you'll never see a craft beer TV ad in which the drinker says, "I can't taste my light beer." If you have a 90 IBU beer, I guarantee you can taste that.
All right. Well, Chris was talking about the beers I tasted, and Chef Lou brought me a dessert beer. How's that?
Oh, great.
So, Chef, what is the dessert beer you brought?
The beer that I brought was a strawberry lambic by Timmermans.
Strawberry lambic?
Yeah. This is produced in Belgium, and it's Sugar Rush. It is a fantastic beer that you can actually incorporate into an ice cream if you decide to.
And they actually put raspberries in it?
Yeah.
Well, this is a strawberry one.
Strawberries, I mean?
Yes.
Well, when I tasted it, it was kind of like, like a rosé champagne, really.
Right.
Is that right?
The lambics are spontaneously fermented, and they have a lot of, wild yeast in them. It gives it a very tart, effervescent character, kind of like a champagne. Unsweetened, they are very tart and very acidic. This one, they add strawberries, and so you get a lot of sweetness from the strawberries.
One of my favorite beer drinks is, you were talking about the Rogue Brewery in Oregon. They put out a chocolate stout that actually has chocolate added to it.
Yeah.
And I poured that into a big glass, and then I put a dollop of Reese's peanut butter ice cream in it. And I had an adult float, and it was the greatest thing I ever drank.
I'll bet. But he also has a couple of craft beers in front of him that are brewed locally, you said?
Yes, yeah. I have a Monk in the Trunk, which is a Belgian amber ale.
And Monk in the Trunk.
Correct, yeah.
Yes, okay.
That's probably what I would pair with that pork chop that you guys had earlier.
It's delicious, really, Chef. That was great, that pork chop.
Yeah, it's amber ales are very diverse because they're not going to be too sweet, not too bitter. They're kind of right in the middle of the road. And then the Belgian yeast in that one gives it some spicy phenolic clove and peppery notes that would go well with that dish. And then I brought the IPA, which I was mentioning before. We have Cigar City's Hi-Li IPA, which is 7.5% alcohol, very hoppy indeed, and you get a lot of citrus.
Hoppy being from hops.
Hops, absolutely.
Okay, great. Just wanted to make sure.
What does IPA stand for?
IPA is India Pale Ale. It's kind of an extension from the Pale Ale category. Going back to when Britain colonized India, they had to ship Pale Ale to the colonizers over in India, and the beer would often spoil.
Right. Mm-hmm. I see.
Yeah, so, well, this has really been fascinating and quite a delicious day. Everyone, Grovetoberfest is this Saturday in Peacock Park. There's still tickets available. Go to grovetoberfest.com for more information. Chef Lou Ramirez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And for the very, very delicious food. And you're going to be making that recipe showing how to make
that. That is correct. We're going to have a cooking demo at the Grovetoberfest at the Kitchen Lab, and we're excited to have you there. There's still tickets available, so we hope to see you there.
Okay. His gastropub is Lou's Beer Garden. It's in North Beach, and it's gotten all kinds of wonderful accolades.
Thank you.
Chris Montelius, thank you for the advice. And of course, for the beer. Well, you both bought beer. There's bottles and bottles of beer here. And I see outside the studio, everyone's lining up.
The jackals are here.
Yeah, thank you. I will definitely be at Grovetoberfest. We're pouring over 20 different beers, and if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, you ate well today. And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Thanks, Lyndon.
Always a pleasure.
Next week, pastry chef extraordinaire Harry Goldsmith with her new book, Baking Out Loud. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance. Follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. And we have free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our new website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with psychologist Dr. Madeline Levine, who says kids' values and coping skills matter more than grades. She's the author of Teach Your Children Well, Parenting for Authentic Success. And to the calendar. On this day in 1975, 37 years ago, Bill Clinton of Hope, Arkansas, marries Hillary Rodham of Chicago at Fayetteville. Hillary bought her wedding dress at Dillard's department store. And on this day, in 2002, 10 years ago, former President Jimmy Carter wins a Nobel Peace Prize for his career of advancing democracy and human rights. And one more while we recall the old fish-eyed fool. On this day in 1991, 21 years ago, the death of comedian Red Fox from a heart attack. His mother was half Seminole. He was successful for raunchy stand-up and party albums until Norman Lear's Sanford and Son came along in 1972. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. It was the idea that Red Fox would be the Black Archie Bunker. And we leave with a thought from the late Red Fox, quote, "Health nuts are going to feel stupid someday, lying in a hospital, dying of nothing." This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation, and good night, Bonnie Berman.
This is